It is September the 7th, and we are on page 172 in Parshas Vayishlach. The last thing we did was in describing the three-part preparation that Yaakov did in regard to his meeting with Esav. And we saw that he prepared for war.
He prepared for war.
Now it's broken, Rabbi.
Go to the other door.
He prepared for war. He davened, and he sent gifts to Esav. And we read through the gifts quickly last time. We showed how he sent a great deal of gifts and how he did it in a way that would make Esav anticipate more and more and more and more, in order that Esav should be appeased with the gifts. Now I want to draw your attention to something which it's perhaps not the most comfortable thing to speak about in a large crowd, but I want to draw your attention to it nevertheless, because I want to show you how sometimes even the most the Torah has hints to many different things and indicates many different things. And the Torah really, as we know, is something that teaches us about life in general, not just about specific laws here or there, but the Torah really does have something to say about every aspect of life. And sometimes we learn these things from parts of the Torah that you would not have expected to teach us about these things. And one of those is in the gifts that Yaakov sent to Esav. Let's examine them a little more carefully than we did last week. Starting on page 172, Pasuk Tesvav 15. The pasuk says, what did he send? He sent Izi Masayim, 200 female goats, Usyashim Esrim, and 20 male goats, Rechemli Masayim, 200 female sheep, Ve'elim Esrim, and 20 male sheep or rams. Gemalim Menikos Uvnehem Shloshim, nursing camels and their children, 30. Paros Arboim, 40 female cows, Ufarim Asara, and 10 male cows, which are bulls, Asonos Esrim, 20 female donkeys, Vayarim Asara, and 10 male donkeys. So that's what he sent. The question is, why these numbers? It's interesting that for the sheep and the goats, the ratio of males to females was 200 to 20. Females to males was 200 to 20. With cows, it was 40 to 10. So let's break it down. Let's start over again. With sheep and goats, the ratio was 10 to 1. With cows, the ratio was 4 to 1. And with donkeys, the ratio was 2 to 1. And with camels, it doesn't mention the males. It just says 30 camels, 30 nursing camels and their children. So, what's with these numbers? The Torah could have just told us he sent a lot of gifts. The fact that the Torah spells it out for us and tells us how many indicates that there's something to learn from the numbers. So, Rashi here cites a medrash based on a Gemara that tells us the following. We know that there are obligations that a husband has for a wife. These obligations include supporting her with food. That's number one. Another one is clothing and shelter. And the third one is what the Torah calls ona, which means her time. Which means that a husband has an obligation to literally spend time with his wife, but the reference is to intimacy. That a husband has an obligation of intimacy with his wife. That's one of the obligations a husband has to his wife. Now, to be sure, a wife has the same obligation to a husband. But when the Torah spells it out, the Torah is talking from the perspective of the husband and saying that these are the three things that he's obligated to give his wife. In the event that he does not provide her with any of these things, or one of these things, that is grounds for her to complain to the court and to file for divorce. These three things must be provided. Now, food and shelter is more straightforward. Because food, you got to give the amount of food that is normally eaten by a person, depending on what they need. The Gemara in Maseches Ksubos discusses that if the woman, for instance, is pregnant, then the food has to be increased because that's necessary. And there are, and shelter and clothing, it depends whether it's the summer or the winter. So it's legislated exactly what the amounts are. When it comes to what is called time, which we're saying is intimacy, so that's a very private matter. And it's a private matter, it depends on the couple, and you would imagine that that's not, it's very difficult to legislate. How is that dealt with in the halacha? And what Rashi tells us from here is that we find that the Torah has an expectation that is linked to how, to the type of job that the husband has. If he has a vocation that allows him to be at home all the time and is not that taxing, it's not physical labor that exhausts him, then his wife can have an expectation that he be available more often. However, if he is very taxed and does a job that is very exhausting, and or if he has a job that takes him to faraway places, then she has to accept the fact that he's not going to be home that often, and he won't be available that often. And that's the way it is. So Rashi tells us this is derived from these verses. Because sheep and goats, not exactly derived, but the idea is derived from here. Because sheep and goats essentially graze all day. They don't work that much. On the other hand, a bull is expected to pull the plow. So the bull is working. It's not just around in the pasture. So that's a taxing job. Donkeys were your tractor trailers in those days. And how did you carry things from one city to another? You loaded up a donkey and you traveled. So the donkey was away a lot. And the camels were your very long distance tractor trailers, or your ocean liners that would go very far away. The camel was your long distance traveler. If you needed to carry a load, not just from city to city, but from country to country, then you used camels. As we saw that Eliezer used camels to carry all the things to Haran when he went to go find a wife for Yitzchak. And so, the Torah is showing us that the proportion of males to females, females to males, the proportion drops as the males become either busier or become away, not available because they're away. And so with sheep and goats, the ratio can be 10 to 1, but when it comes to the cows, it's down to 4 to 1, and for the donkeys, it's down to 2 to 1. So that's one thing that is derived from here. Very interesting thing. We never would have thought to make the connection, but you do see this notion that the expectation changes depending on the job that the male has. But there's one more thing that's learned from here. Let me say this and then we can ask our questions. One more thing that's derived from here is, what about the camels? It says, the camels that you're going to ask, the camels, the nursing camels and their children. The Medrash tells us that this word, uvnehem, and their children, should not be read uvnehem and their children, but rather ubonehem, and those that build them up, referring to their males, the male counterparts. And that the camels had, there were 30 females, there were 30 males. The ratio was 1 to 1, because as I mentioned, the camel travels the furthest and is not available, is available the least of all of these animals. And therefore the ratio is 1 to 1. So then why does the Torah couch it as their children? That's a funny thing to say. Say the male camels. And the Gemara says, because now this I cannot tell you, I'm not a farmer, I don't know how these things work. But the Gemara says that camels, apparently this is a well-known thing, are more sanua, are more modest with their intimacy than other animals. Animals are not modest with intimacy. They're animals. People are modest with intimacy, not animals. But camels apparently have an instinct to be modest with their intimacy. Since the camel is intimate in a modest way, the Torah too does not bring up the subject of male and female camels in an open, overt way. Instead, it couches it in a hidden way. Nursing camels and their children, which we read in a different way to mean their husbands, their male counterparts, because they are modest. So the Torah also presents it in a modest fashion. Very interesting thing. Fascinating thing how the Torah is so careful in presenting these things because of how the animals act. So this is not something that we would have thought of on our own. It's not something we would have, wildest imagination have thought of. But it's an interesting thing, the way the Torah presents it. I bring it up because I want you to see that the Torah is much broader than what meets the eye. And even the simple storyline, sometimes there's much deeper meaning to it. Sometimes we know what it is, sometimes we don't know what it is. But there's depth and depth and depth and things that we derive from it. Any other questions on this? Okay. Now we'll get back to the main point. So he sends the gift. So we mentioned last time, let's reread starting from Yudches 18. He sent them in groups, one at a time. Vayitzav es harishon leimar. He commanded the first one, saying, Ki ifgashcha Esav achi, when Esav, my brother, meets you, ushelcha leimar, and he'll ask you, saying, quote, Lemi ata, to whom are you? Which means, who do you belong to? You're obviously messengers, so who are you coming from? Va'ana seleich, and where are you going? Ulemi eile lefanecha, and to whom are these things in front of you? Which means, these animals that you're taking with you, who are they going to? So where are you coming from? Where are you going? And to whom are these? Who are they for? Va'amartel, you should answer. We're going to answer each question one by one. La'avdecha le'Yaakov. The first question was, to whom are you? Who do you belong to? So we belong to your servant Yaakov. The second question was, where are you going? So the second question is answered. Mincha hi shlucha. This is a gift that is being sent. We are en route to deliver a gift. And the third question is, ulemi eva lefanecha, to whom are these things that are before you? The answer is Ladonila Esav, to my master, to Esav. So that's the three answers to the three questions. We are from Yaakov. We are en route to deliver a gift, and these are being given to my master, to Esav. V'hinei gam hu acharenu, and behold, also he, meaning Yaakov, is coming behind us. He's following behind us. So, to me, this verse is striking, because, especially this time of year, heading towards Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, the high holidays, think of the words, L'mi ata, to whom do you belong? V'ana seleich, and where are you going? U'lami eila lefanecha, and to whom are these things that are in front of you? Isn't that a broader question than simply what is here in front of us? Right? The question is much, much deeper than simply where are these animals going. Esav is asking a much more serious question over here. What is the direction of these people? Where are you coming from? What is your purpose? And where are you going? Who are these for? It harkens back to the way that the angel spoke to Hagar. If you'll recall, when she ran away from Sarah, we talked about this extensively, when she ran away from Sarah and the angel appeared to her at the well, back in Parashas Lech Lecha, let me find the page, on page 70, in verse 8, Pasuk Ches, the angel says to Hagar, Vayomar, and he said, Hagar Shifchas Sarai, Hagar, the maid of Sarai, Eimi Zevas, where are you coming from? V'ana Seleichian, where are you going? Think about it. What's going on over here? You've got to think of the broader picture. Don't get focused on the one thing, the one here and now. You have to keep the broader picture in mind. Where are you coming from? Where are you going? Yaakov is telling his messengers over here, when Esav asks you these questions, Esav might mean the simple question, but there's a broader question here as well. One should always keep in mind the broader picture. Where are they coming from? Where are they going? The psukim continue. Yes.
In here, it says one statement. It says, Satan, the evil inclination, and the angel of death are one and the same.
Okay. What is the context about that? What is it referring to?
Satan descended in to seduce the man to sin. But that's the first time I've ever heard that the angel of death and the...
And they're into a whole thing. Oh, this is the struggle. This is the struggle with the angel. Okay, let's bear that in mind. That's very good. Well, and we will get to that. The struggle with the angel, between Yaakov and the angel, is coming up.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Keep that in mind, because if we don't begin that tonight, keep that in mind for next week. So hold on to that. We may get to that tonight. Okay. So he commands the second one similarly, the third one similarly, and all of them, and they all go. Okay. Now, starting from, we read this really last week. So starting from 22, Chafes. Vatavar hamincha al panav. The gift passed by his face, which literally means Yaakov stood there and oversaw the gift leaving. Each convoy, he saw it go. You know, it got to the horizon, then he sent the next one, got to the horizon, then he sent the next one, each one after the other. So he followed it. He watched it go. And then it says, V'hu lon balayla ha'hu b'machaneh. He slept that night in the camp. Now, the Torah takes pains here to tell us how many days have passed from the beginning of this parasha to now. And I want to now go through carefully with you the days that passed. The Torah introduced to us the whole story with that Yaakov sent angels in front of him to Esav to see what was going on. They returned to say, Esav is coming after you with 400 men. He hasn't calmed down yet. Okay. So he prepares. And we said, how did he prepare? He prepared, number one, with?
He's still
separating the camps, that's preparing for war. Number two?
Prayer.
Number three? Gifts. But there is a break between number two and number three. If you look back at Pasuk, yes, thank you. Good Dalit, 14. The Torah has just finished telling us his prayer. So first, he split the camps. Then he prays. Then it says in 14, Yodalad, Vayolen sham balayla hahu, he slept there that night. Vayikach min habav yado, minchal Esav achiv, then he took from what came into his hand a gift for Esav his brother. So that he slept over, he waited a night before he sent the gift. So where he started with the preparation for war and the prayer, they will call that day one. Then he sleeps over, and on day two he sends the gift. Now he sleeps again. It says in 22, "V'hu lan balayla ha'u b'machaneh," and he slept that night in the camp. Now lan does not literally mean to sleep; it actually means to stay overnight. It doesn't have to mean that he actually closed his eyes and went to sleep. I don't know whether he went to sleep, didn't go to sleep. That's irrelevant. The point is that a night passed. So now we're heading into day number three. Now, it's interesting that the first time in Pasuk Yudalad in 14, it just says he slept there that night. Here it says, not there, but it says he slept where? In the camp. The first time it doesn't say in the camp. The second time it says in the camp. To me that suggests that it's getting more closer to war. It's becoming more like a camp. The camp here means an encampment of an army. Where the first time, even though he had already split his family into two camps, but they weren't ready for war. Now they're ready for war. He slept in the camp. Sounds like a fortress. They're ready for battle. Things are getting closer. If on the first day he split the camp and he prayed, but he didn't send the gift until the second day, that suggests that he knew Esav was not yet imminently upon him. He knew he had another day, because he had sent messengers to Esav, who then came back and reported about Esav. So he knew where Esav was and how fast he was traveling. So Yaakov must have known how much time he had. So on the first day, he quickly split the camp and prayed. But he waited to the next day to send the gift. Apparently he wanted the gift to be closer to the time that Esav was going to be upon him. So he sent the gift on the second day. But really, Esav wasn't going to get it until the third day. So that night, the second night, he sleeps over. But here, a curious thing happens. Pasuk, Chaf Gimel 23, Vayakam Balailahu. He got up that night. He didn't wait until the third day. In the middle of that night, of the second night, he got up. Vayikach es shtei nashav ves shtei shifchosav. And he took his two wives and his two maids, Bilhah and Zilpah. Ve'achan asa yiladav, and his 11 sons. Vayavor es ma'avar Yabok. And he crossed the crossing of Yabok. They call it the ford of Yabok, meaning the place that is easiest to cross. Yabok was a river. And he crossed Yabok at its crossing. Vayikachem, and he took them. Vayavirem es hanochal, and he crossed them across the brook or the river. Vayaver es hashelo, and he brought over what was his. As Rashi explains, he had a lot of things, and he took from one side of the river to the other, from one side to the other. He went to this ford of Yabok, and he crossed first the people. Then he went back and got his things and crossed those things. Went back and crossed those things.
When did he get them back together? The people.
Okay. So he had already split them.
Right.
Now they're back together.
Right.
There seems to be a change of plans. But here, he's got them all together. He had originally split them into two camps. And now, he's got them all together. Something happened in the middle of this night that causes Yaakov to change plans. To get up in the middle of the night and start moving people around, it seems like there's something going on, something perhaps that's being done stealthily.
They were all together.
They're all together?
No. He took them, they were before them together. He just brought them.
Well, it doesn't say where, it doesn't say where they were. It says he got up and he took them and he crossed them across the Yabok. So he could have taken them from two different places. It doesn't say where they were. But certainly he brought them across together.
Obviously, he was scared. He was
scared. Something is happening.
That he might say from my heart, though.
Something is happening.
How many people does he have that he's preparing for war? Does he have an army?
Well, he
has children and wives and servants that are going with the animals.
Right, right. The children, like, you know, the servants, that's what he has. I mean, that's what it is. The children were very powerful, as we know from later on. They were still young at this point. The oldest would have been at this point not more than 13 years old, but they were powerful people. Later on we find that they're very, very strong. So 13 is still not the same strength as a 30-year-old, but they may have been quite powerful. At any rate, you're right. We don't know of any soldiers that he had, per se. But here, he crosses them in the middle of the night. Now I want to draw your attention to an interesting nuance. In the beginning of Chaf Gimel 23, Vayakam Balaila Hu. He got up that night. There's a letter missing over here. What would have been the typical way to write this? Vayakam Balaila.
Haim.
Not Haim. You're close though. What would be, there's a letter missing in front of the word Hu. Usually the way you would find this phrase is Vayakam Balaila Ha Hu. On that night, the hey hayadia, the definite article. On that night, he got up. That prefix hey is missing. It says vayakam balayla hu. He got up on night on it's difficult to read. It still reads as that night in English, but in Hebrew, there is a letter missing. We find this structure one other time recently that we read in Parshas Vayetze. The same structure. And there, Rashi tells us what it means. If you look back in Parshas Vayetze, on page 156, Pasuk Tez Zion, verse 16, this was a fateful Pasuk. This is after the deal between Rachel and Leah with the Dudaim, with the flowers, where they traded nights of Yaakov, they bartered a night of Yaakov. Vayavo Yaakov min asadeh ba'erev. Yaakov came from the field at night. Vateitse le'ali kraso. Leah came out to greet him. Vatomer, she said, Eli tavo, you should come to me. Ki sachar sechartichah, for I have rented you. I have paid for you. Bedudae v'ni, with the dudaim, with the flowers of my son. Vayishkav ima, and he slept with her. Balayla hu, on that night. Again, it doesn't say balayla ha-hu, like you normally find. Rather, it says balayla hu. Rashi tells us, why does it say balayla hu? Because hu means he. And when the word hu is used, sometimes it's a reference to Hashem, as in a capital H, he, him, God. And Rashi says over here, that who, meaning him, God, assisted, helped Leah this night, that she should conceive the next two tribes, Yisachar and Zebulun. Because of her, we talked about this at the time, her effort that she was putting in to try to have as many tribes as possible, God intervened over here and made sure she would have the next tribe, Yisachar. So the word who, without that first hey, can be a reference to Hashem. If we then use that same format over here, Vayakam balayla hu, he got up that night. Apparently there is a divine intervention going on over here. Had things remained as they were, Yaakov would have remained on the other side of the Yabok. He was on one side of the Yabok, the river Yabok, and he crossed it. Had he remained on the one side of the Yabok with his family in two camps, it would have been disastrous. But that night, apparently with divine intervention, I'm suggesting that he got some kind of a sign from on high. He got up in the middle of the night and changed plans and brought his family across the Yabok. Now, if that's really what happened, clearly this river Yabok then is significant. What is so important about this river Yabok? What's the difference between being on one side of the Yabok and being on the other side of the Yabok? What's the difference?
Can we assume that he did not want all of his possessions to go over there, and therefore he's withholding?
Well, he crossed all his possessions as well.
Yeah, it says he sent over his possessions. But can you just sort of assume that it was just a way of, you'll send over a few pieces for peace. But he didn't really want all of it to get over there at the time.
Send over doesn't mean to Esav. It means to cross the river. That's where he will set up his new camp.
Oh,
would it have to do with whatever angels were in charge? Is one side in Israel and the other side not?
Okay. So let's get our bearings over here. Remember, at the end of Parshas Vayetze, Yaakov was returning from Lavan. So he was coming back to Israel, and he came to the last couple of psukim on page 168. And at the end of Parshas Vayetze, they tell us that it says in Pasuk Beis, verse 2, V'Yaakov halach l'darko v'yifku v'malachei Elokim. Yaakov went on his way, and he was met by angels of God. V'yomer Yaakov ka'asher ra'am. Yaakov said when he saw them, Machanei Elokim zed, this is the camp of God. V'yikra shem ha'makom ha'u machanoyim. and he called the name of that place Machanayim. Machanayim means double camp. Camp. That's what it means. So Rashi explains to us, when Yaakov left Israel, as we saw, he had the dream with the ladder, and at that time angels were going up and angels were going down, and the simple meaning over there was that Yaakov was leaving Israel. So the Israeli angels were going upstairs, and the diaspora angels were coming downstairs to join him in his sojourn out of Israel, because the different angels accompany people in different places. Israel has special angels, they're Israeli, and then there are non-Israeli angels who accompany people outside of Israel. So they were switching. So here too, now they're switching back. Now that he's on his way back in, so the diaspora angels are being met by the Israeli angels. That's why it's called camp, because the camp from outside of Israel is meeting up with the camp from inside of Israel. There's two camps are meeting together at this place called Machanayim. Was he yet in Israel or not? So the casual reader would assume he was in Israel because the Israeli angels are greeting him. But that's not necessarily the case, because they may have come out to greet him on his way in, which makes sense. That as when you have someone coming into your home, you go out to greet them, to bring them into your home.
So the yabok must be some dividing line.
Okay. Okay. So is the yabok the dividing line?
The green zone.
The green zone. Okay. Okay. Remember that he was still on the east side of the Jordan. He hasn't crossed the Jordan River yet. He's on the east side of the Jordan. He's coming from that side. He's coming from the east. He's on the east side of the Jordan River. Now, the east side of the Jordan River is also ours. What is present-day Jordan is also biblically ours. The east side of the Jordan was occupied at the time that the Jews came to that part of when they came there from at the end of the 40 years. It was occupied by Sihon and Og, the two powerful kings living on that side of the Jordan. And they were, God told Moshe, they're yours. You can conquer them. They're yours to take. It's land that I've designated for the Jewish people. Moshe, nevertheless, sent a message to Sihon, a peaceful message. Just let us go by. We don't want to fight. Sihon said, nothing doing. And Sihon attacked. So he attacked. We defeated him, and we conquered his land. And that's the Aver HaYarden. That is the part of Israel which is on the east side of the Jordan River. Later, it was the tribes that lived there were Reuven, Gad, and half the tribe of Menashe. Now, I didn't bring my map with me. I should have done that. But if you can picture it, you're facing me. So here's the Jordan River. This would be the west side of the Jordan, which is Israel proper. This is the east side of the Jordan, which is where we're talking about. To the north and to the south were two different countries. To the south was the country of Moab. To the north was the country of Ammon. We were prohibited from fighting with either Ammon or Moab. Why were we prohibited from fighting with them? They're the children of Lot. And Hashem tells us, we'll see much later in the Chumash, I have given those lands to Lot for his temporary inheritance. Later on, Le'asid Lavo, when Mashiach comes, we will be given their lands as well. But for the time being, Hashem tells Moshe, you may not enter the lands of Ammon, nor may you enter the land of Moab. They're off limits currently for the Jewish people. Eventually, they'll become yours.
So what is that today? Syria? And
no, Syria is even further north. Syria was also part of Israel. It's not exactly, we don't know exactly where the borders were of these places. Although, it's funny that Amman, Jordan, sounds very much like Ammon. At any rate, so those places were off limits. If we look in, hold the place, but we're going to turn very far ahead. Look at page 952 in Parashas Devarim. Here, you know that in Sefer Devarim, the book of Devarim of Deuteronomy, Moshe recounts a lot of what happened in the Chumash. A lot of it is a repetition of what happened before with explanatory notes. Moshe is saying more than what happened before, explaining more to us. So here, Moshe is recounting that battle between the Jewish people and Sihon and Og, where we conquered the east side of the Jordan River. And Moshe is telling us which places were conquered. And a lot of names are being thrown around over here that we're not familiar with. It's hard for us to place them because we don't know exactly where these places are. But basically, it was a rout. We decimated them. We were able to completely conquer them. There was no opposition whatsoever. We were able to completely take over the lands. And in Pasuk Lamed Vav, in 36, which I can read, but it's not going to tell us that much, he tells us some of the borders of where they conquered. May Aroer, from the place called Aroer, Asher al Sfas Nachal Arnon, which is on the banks of the river Arnon, V'ho'ir Asher Banachal, and the river and the city that was in the river, V'ad HaGilad, and until the place called Gilad, Lo Ha'isak Kiryah Asher Sagva Mimenu, there was no village that was spared from us, Es HaKol, all of it, Nasan Hashem Elokeinu Lefanenu, God put before us, God gave to us. Then, here's the pivotal verse, Lamed Zayin 37. Rak el Eretz b'nei Amon lo karavta. Only, you did not get close to the land of the children of Amon. That was off limits. You didn't encroach on their land. Kol yad nachal yabok, all the edge of the river Yabok, v'arei hahar, and the cities of the mountain, I don't know what that is, v'chol asher tziva Hashem Elokeinu, and all that Hashem our God commanded us, that you didn't touch. You didn't touch the area around the river Yabok. That's already Amon territory. Turn the page, 954. After it was conquered by the Jewish people, then Reuven and Gad and half of Manasseh were allocated those lands. And the Torah goes on to tell us which parts of the lands that were formerly owned by Sihon and Og, which parts were given to Reuven, which parts were given to Gad, which parts were given to Manasseh. The division is laid out for us. So on the bottom of the page, Tez Zayin 16, V'la Reuveni v'la Gadi, Moshe is telling us that to the Reuven tribe and to the Gad tribe, Nasati I gave, Min HaGilad, I gave the land from the Gilad, V'ad Nachal Arnon, and until the river Arnon, Tocha Nachal, in the river, Ugevul, and the edge of the river, V'ad Yabok HaNachal, and until the river Yabok, until the Yabok River, Gevul b'nei Amon, the boundary of the children of Amon. I gave them up until the river Yabok, which is the boundary into the land of Amon. And that was off limits. Yabok is the dividing line between out of Israel and in Israel. Whether Yaakov was fully aware of where that dividing line would end up being, I don't know. Because, as I mentioned to you, in the future, we will get the land of Amon as well. So ultimately, it was all promised to Abraham, including the river Yabok and beyond. But in biblical times, when the Jews entered Israel, we were only given up until the river Yabok. Yaakov, in the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach, finds himself on the wrong side of the river Yabok, on the Amon side of the river Yabok. Now, Amon was born, but he wasn't yet a nation. They didn't live there yet, or maybe they did, but they didn't have, it wasn't like the boundaries were so delineated yet. We're talking, the psukim later on, we're talking several hundred years later, when we talk about the boundary between Amon and Sihon and Og. So here, it wasn't yet set up. But he found himself on the side of the river Yabok that would ultimately be the land of Amon. That night, apparently with divine intervention, some kind of premonition, Yaakov gets up in the middle of the night and crosses his family. And that crossing brings them into the land of Israel. into what would biblically be ours. That changes everything. Now they find themselves in the land of Israel, on the east side of the Jordan, but in what would ultimately be our land. And he crosses all of his people over there. And now we enter that major struggle, that epic struggle. Chaf Hey 25. Vayivaser Yaakov Levado. Yaakov remained alone. Vayeyavek Ish Imo Ad Alos Hashachar. And a man, what do they translate it as? Struggled?
Wrestled
with him until the morning light. Alos Hashachar means false dawn. It's in the halacha, Alos Hashachar is 72 minutes before sunrise.
Why wouldn't he have gone and stayed with his family that he had now crossed over?
Okay.
He's still getting his possessions.
Okay. He was still getting his possessions. He crossed the people first, then he went back for his possessions. And he was crossing his possessions. It took time. Rashi says he was like a human bridge. He was going back and forth, and back and forth, bringing across all of his things. He did not ask his family to participate in getting all his things across the river. Why not? Why didn't he just have everybody do it? What did they say? Many hands make light work. What has the saying go? Right? Let everybody work together. It seems to me that Yaakov understood that side of the Yabok was safe. This side is not safe. He may not have known why one was safe and one was not safe. He may not have known what the imminent danger was, but he knew there was danger. And everybody had to get across. The first thing he does is gets all the people across. Then he says, I'm not endangering anybody else. I will go back to bring the possessions. And he goes back and forth and back and forth. And he was left alone on the wrong side.
But isn't Esau on the side that they crossed?
Yes. So what's the danger? So what's the danger, right? It would seem you're going to the danger, not,
right?
Right? It seems like going the wrong way. So this is a fascinating thing. Sometimes, what appears to be going towards the danger is actually going away from the danger. Sometimes, what seems to be the safe place is actually the dangerous place. We don't always know the big picture. And over here, what we're about to see is that going towards Esav was actually safer than remaining further away across the Yabok.
That's because God told him to go.
Right. But we understand because one side was holy. The other side was not. Was mundane. One side was Israel. The other side was not Israel. Yaakov was safer in Israel than out of Israel. And out of Israel, he meets up with this man who was not Esav, who fights with him. And they have a struggle. This is a struggle to the death between Yaakov and this man. The word vayeyavek is an interesting word. I don't believe it's found anywhere else. I think Rashi tells us this is a unique word, which they translate as to wrestle. Rashi tells us it's derived from several ways. One way it's derived is that the word yeyavek has the word avak in it. Avak means dust. Because when people are wrestling and trying to knock each other over, if they're on a dusty place, the dust rises around them. And that's what happened. It was a very big battle between the two of them. It was hand-to-hand combat. And the dust was rising around them. Vayeyavek can also mean to embrace. Not embrace in a loving way, but rather to put in a bear hug. To put in a neck, in a headlock. Vayeyavek is to grab. So they were wrestling with each other, trying to knock each other down. And this went on until the first light, till Alos HaShachar.
Why does it refer to him as an ish, if it's supposed to be an angel?
Okay, so our sages tell us this is not a man, this is an angel. This is an angel, yes?
And if he's seen angels before, wouldn't he know? I mean, like, I thought before, if someone saw angels before, they could recognize
him. He would know it's an angel, yeah. Okay. It's clear that Yaakov knew it was an angel, because this did not look like a man. In fact, in the...
He came much not Abraham at the angel when they came the third day, and he had a dreadful thought.
It does say that over there, but there they were disguised as human beings. Mm-hmm. When we read before on Sukkot coming up, when we read Tfilas Geshem, the prayer for rain, which is read, prayed on Shmini Atzeres, on the eighth day of the holiday of Sukkot. So there's like a poem that is read. It's read by the Chazan in Shul.
It's considered behind me.
Is Shul listening to it?
Okay.
Right there. Excellent. Okay. Thank you. Let's see if we can find it quickly. This poem is not well known because it's not something that's said, it's only said once a year, and it's said by the Chazan. But the poem goes, Zechar Tan Maklo, remember the one who took his stick, Va'avar Yardin Mayim, across the Jordan water. Remember we said that because Yaakov had everything stolen from him on his way to Lavan, his only way to cross the Jordan all he had was his stick. And he put the stick in the water and the water split. And he was able to cross. So remember him. Yachad Lev, the Go'ev Mipi Be'er Mayim. He dedicated his heart and he rolled the stone off of the well of water. This is a reference to, we're talking about water over here, so every reference to water is being mentioned. It's all about Yaakov. Kinevach lo sar, when he wrestled with, it was wrestled with him, a sar means a prince, or an angel, okay, here they translate an angel. Bolu me'esh umimayim. This angel was a mixture of fire and water. This was no human being. The makeup of this angel was fire and water mixed together. And the poem ends, at least the stanza ends, L'chein yiftachto hayos imo ve'esh uvamayim. Therefore, you guaranteed him, you Hashem guaranteed Yaakov that you will be with him through fire and through water. And then we end off, on his merit, don't hold back water from us, the rain. So, when referring to this angel, the Paitan, the poet, refers to the angel as a mixture of fire and water. And that's what Yaakov is fighting with over here. The supernatural being that Yaakov is fighting with. Yaakov, as we know, is very, very powerful, both physically and spiritually, and is able to wage war with this supernatural being. And it goes on all night.
Is fire and water symbolic of good and evil?
What? It's like the
Makos
of hail.
Yeah. Hail is awesome.
It reminds of the hail, right? Of the hail in Egypt. Right. As a mixture of fire and water. Okay, I don't know if we can use good and evil as an analogy over here, but we'll see if we can think of something that will fit it in.
Do
they say good and evil?
Yeah. Thus the battle between Yaakov and the man was the eternal struggle between good and evil.
No, that is for sure true. That's true. Mm-hmm. No, but Mrs. Starkman was asking whether the fire and water is a reference to good and evil. Yeah. Okay. So, they have this battle. Now, there is so much to talk about here that I'm not sure whether we should begin talking or at least finish the short part of the story before we run out of time tonight. So, let's at least finish okay.
The question is, why did he need the battle? Hashem promised that he would protect them, and he'd protect them until he would return. What was the purpose of this battle?
Okay, that's a good question. He was left alone, and he was left alone on the wrong side. Now, our sages tell us that he was almost finished. He had finished clearing everything out, and crossed the Yabok, but he had forgotten one item. Okay, pachim kitanim, small flasks. And he went back to get those small flasks, and that's when the angel attacked him. Now, some of you may have already heard my talk on Hanukkah about these small flasks and Yaakov going back for them. What was so important about them? It is a class in and of itself, and we certainly don't have time tonight to discuss it. And I'm reluctant to repeat it here because I think there are those of you here who have already heard it, and I don't want to repeat it anyway.
For the benefit of those who didn't, repeat it anyway.
It's online.
It's okay.
Okay. All right. So we'll leave that, but not for tonight. We'll get to that either next week or the week after. We'll leave that for the timing. But we'll get. It's much too long to start tonight. We'll have to leave it for later. Okay. We'll get to that. We'll get to that. We'll get to it. At any rate. So he went back for those flasks. They are important. We'll have to discuss what the importance of them were later. And that's when he meets this angel. The angel meets him outside of Israel. That's very significant. He's going to meet Esav inside of Israel. But the angel, he meets outside of Israel. Our sages tell us this angel is the angel of Esav. This is the Esav angel. Every nation has their own angel. The Egyptians had their own angel. The Moabites have their own angel. Every nation has their own angel. Prior to the defeat of the nation, God has the angel defeated. Because as we know, as we've talked about before, especially in the Yechezkel class, angels are simply manifestations of what goes on down here. They are either reflective of what has already happened down here, or they are reflective of what will happen down here. But that's the way angels function. And they are symbolic of what is happening here. Things change down here. We have free will. So therefore, things can happen here that change. Angels don't have free will. So upstairs, everything remains stagnant unless things change down here. As things change down here, that affects what goes on up there. And so the angels are reflective of what is happening here, or what will happen here. When Hashem is about to have a country defeated, the angel falls first. For instance, in Sefer Yehoshua, the book of Joshua, when he's about to initiate the conquest of Eretz Israel, Israel at the time was occupied by no fewer than 31 kingdoms. It was seven nations, but 31 kingdoms. God, it says, took the angels of those 31 kingdoms, placed them on the ground, and told Yehoshua to put his foot on top of those angels to show that he was going to conquer all 31 of those kingdoms, which of course he did. This angel, being the angel of Esav, is symbolic of this battle that goes on through the generations between Yaakov and Esav. And Hashem did not take the angel and put him on the ground and have Yaakov put his foot on top of him. Instead, as Mrs. Starkman pointed out, what happens? There's a struggle. They wrestle. And how long does the battle take? All night long. For hours and hours, they're struggling and fighting. And it is not until the first light that the battle will end and we'll see that Yaakov is victorious. The symbolism is that this struggle between Yaakov and Esav is not a simple battle and it will not end quickly. It is a long, drawn-out battle. Eventually, Yaakov will end up on top. But it's going to take a long time. And it will not be without injury, as we'll see. As Yaakov will be hurt in the battle. He will not escape unscathed. Because this battle is the battle of history between Yaakov and Esav. Between good and evil. This is the symbolic of that battle. It happens outside of Israel. It happens when Yaakov is left alone. And they struggle at night, not during the day, but at night. Why at night, not during the day?
symbolic of the exile?
Right. Night is symbolic of the exile. Outside of Israel is where the battle happened. Symbolic of exile. That's where the battle takes place. We look back at Jewish history and we say to ourselves, we've been out of Israel now for nearly 2,000 years. And the bulk of Jewish history has taken place where? Not in Israel, but outside of Israel. We've had Israel now for a very long time. It was given to us more than 3,000 years ago. But we haven't been there for that long, relatively speaking. The struggle between Yaakov and Esav takes place outside of Israel. That's where the struggle really takes place. Where we are now, out of Israel. And that's where Yaakov eventually emerges victorious. And that's what this represents. And so, I leave you now with the following points that we still have to clarify. One, as I said, is what are these flasks? And as I said, I don't know if we'll get to it next week. It may take 2 weeks before we get to that one. We have to discuss the battle itself and the coming of the first light and the next few verses of what happens in the battle, Yaakov becoming injured, etc. And also Yaakov being left alone. That's a very, very significant point as well. These things all come together in understanding this battle. I will just attempt and answer one question that was asked, which is, why is he referred to as an Ish, as a man, when it was really an angel? And Yaakov knew it was an angel. But I would suggest, perhaps, because his battle with Yaakov, it wasn't angel against man. It was no worse than man against man. Yaakov was just as powerful as the angel. Angel against man stands no chance. The angel will defeat the man easily. But this angel was diminished to a man because Yaakov was really angelic. Yaakov had the power of an angel. So it was no different than a man-to-man combat rather than an angel-to-man combat. Perhaps that's why he's referred to as a man. Let me just review the schedule. Next week, the 14th, we will meet regular time, Blin Eder at 7:30. There is a wedding that day as well, but at least the part that I'm invited to is over by that point. So we will meet on the 14th, the regular time. On the 21st, there is a guest speaker, and that is Rabbi Weinreb, who's coming in. He is a great speaker. I will tell you more about him if I remember to tell you more about him next week. I am very fond of him. But his talk is, I believe, at 7:15 on the 21st. And so I think that it is worthwhile for all of us to attend his talk. Yeah, it's at 7:15, which would preclude our class that night on the 21st. So we would then have our next class, we have it on the 14th, and then again on the 28th, which would be right before Rosh Hashanah. I have no reason not to meet on the 28th. Rosh Hashanah starts on Monday night, the 29th. I'm okay meeting on the 28th at 7:30. I understand, especially the women in the room may not be able to do that. I'm willing to, you can tell me next week, I'm willing to hear yay or nay on that, but I'm willing to do it. It's okay? It's all right? Okay. Fine.
Thank you.
Thank you.